Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Mully and Hall, up early to start your day with Chicago Sports Talk.
I got to tell you, I'm absolutely loving it right now.
Oh, my God, my God.
Time to catch you up on this morning's show so far.
This is for you.
Let's go.
Foul ball left side. Eloy over there, and he ends up in the net again.
Yeah, that's one of the things that he might want to take out of the equation.
Barring the idea of creating an electronic fence and putting a collar on the guy so he's aware of when he's running into trouble, I keep focusing on that net. Like, that net is there to protect the fans that aren't there. What are we protecting? Why not swap that out and make it some sort of, like, trampoline effect where he could easily just jump off it and bounce back into play? This is an accident waiting to happen. And it's the third time that we've seen him run afoul of issues, so someone's got to talk to him.
Mike Mulligan
is fearless, he's observant, and has great emotional intelligence.
David Hall.
He's a winner, he's intelligent, he's innovative, he has strong character.
Now the 2-1 pitch, bounced toward the middle, that's gloved by Baez, steps on second, throws to first, low dugout by Rizzo, double play, and the Cubs win the ball game.
You have to like the look of the Cubs and everything that they do, right? The pitching depth, the timely hitting, they've got talent, they've got character, they've got commitment, and they've got discipline. David Ross looks really smart right now because the pitchers are going deep into games. The bullpen even looks manageable. I still think that is going to be something that you worry about. We're 1/4 of the way through the season, though, already. 25% in, and the Cubs are off to their best start in 50 years. I think that you can, without exaggeration, say the Cubs look like legit World Series contenders 1/4 of the way into this season.
Mully and Hall on 670 The Score.
Let's freaking go.
Mully and Hall, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score. It's been a great, great morning so far. We have so many fun things to pick apart and talk about. And it will obviously continue. Very excited about our baseball teams winning, certainly. The Sox getting their head above 500 again. Oh, that is a relief. I don't know why. It's how I'm going about my life. And the Cubs are just a juggernaut. You just want to see the Cubs against the best teams in baseball. You just want to fast forward to a point where you get to find out just how good they are, right? I mean, I don't know that we're getting a good enough feel for how good they are. They certainly have been up to any task thus far. And it just makes you want more. It's as simple as that.
Well, they made easy work of the Indians, and that's a pretty good team. So, yeah, definitely the Cubs look the part. Both teams, the Sox and the Cubs, look like they have regained form in the Sox's case. And they look like a playoff contender again. And that's fun to consider here in Chicago baseball in October. We've got the Blackhawks in the midst of their postseason game two today, this afternoon, 4:30. Against the Golden Knights. And Mully, the Bears are back in camp, and we have talked this week because this is a really critical week for college football. The Big Ten did what it did the other day, and yesterday the Big 12 announced plans to kind of move forward and proceed with its schedule optimistically. We expect the ACC and the SEC to be, you know, not changing their plans. And so I think you find yourself kind of in this weird dynamic as a college football fan. You're going to have some conferences playing, some conferences waiting, and you're going to have basically college football and all throughout the calendar. I don't know if that's good. I don't know if that's bad, but I don't really like the way that it's kind of dispersed that way. I don't like that there's no uniformity in the approach for these programs, because I think long term it's going to create some deeper, more troubling issues moving forward.
I thought it was really interesting listening to Matt Nagy yesterday. At one point, he was asked a question about how you go about evaluating the players on teams that don't play. I would expand that a little bit, because I don't know how you go about evaluating players on teams where you only play against a limited number of teams. You don't get to see them outside of their conference. You don't get to evaluate players in the same fashion you normally would, with like crossovers between different conferences. I'd be very curious to talk to some scouts about how you work that thing. And I thought one of the powerful voices that talked about this came from Joe Burrow, just basically saying, hey, if I wouldn't even be drafted, I wouldn't be in the position I'm in now if I hadn't had my senior season. Because in a lot of ways, that guy was a one-year wonder, right? I mean, he struggled at Ohio State. He transfers to LSU. He gets his chance. And it turns out the accuracy, everything that he did was absolutely incredible. And he did it with a really good team. And he ends up being the top pick in the draft. That indicates to me that there are going to be players that nobody's heard about that may not get to show how good they are. And, I mean, who knows? Who knows where the whole thing ends up?
I loved what Joe Burrow had to say. I really did, because it showed a self-awareness of how important that last season was to him and how rare it really is to see that happen. But, Molly, I did also wonder this. I wondered if his reward would make other players and other fans and other coaches feel like it was worth the risk because of what happened to Joe Burrow, and because the risk is there in every program and you can't ignore it. And I think what we're finding is that different programs and conferences throughout the country are weighing those risks differently. They're looking at science like it's more of a slogan and not a fact. And this guy we want to believe in this. And well, you know, show me the facts, show me the science, and show me the medical data that you're using to support your argument. And I wondered this, and I want to ask you a question. We talked about it a little bit yesterday with Layla. And when you look at the potential hazards of playing this season, you know, in the midst of a pandemic, like the SEC, ACC, and Big 12 seem intent to do, are those risks higher than the Big Ten, for instance, trying to play two regular seasons within 1 9-month period? Because I think you have situations that present health hazards either way. But if you were weighing them, which one do you think is heavier with risk?
Yeah, that is a great question, because I think that trying to get two football seasons into that short a time period is insane to me. But I think for a school, I think it's different depending on the program, and that's one of the reasons that it's bad, because I think that Ohio State, for instance, could have a group of players that play their season and then graduate into the NFL, be it your senior class and your junior class, and then you bring up a whole new bunch of players to play the second season. See what I'm saying? Right. Whereas other programs where guys stay in school, Northwestern comes to mind, where you're playing basically the same players for 2 years, right? Because your junior class are going to be your seniors. It's rare that you see these guys going out to get into the NFL. I think that is what would really concern me, would be the disparity between the programs, the individual programs within a conference. Now, maybe it would help some teams, but I think what we're talking about is the idea of putting that much football on someone's body within a 1 year period where you could damage someone, you could get injuries, you could get, you know, you'll be looking for trends of what happens without any kind of significant layoff.
Jerry DiNardo yesterday was great, Molly, talking about the potential of putting players on sort of a play count, like a pitch count. And so say if you had 1,000 snaps in the spring and you were a starter, that you would have to kind of delay when you would begin your season next fall. Whether it would, and I don't know how that would work, but I think he opened the door to he wants to study that. He thinks football coaches should examine that and explore if that's the case and that's the reality they're dealing with, because that is a big ask to put on the bodies and the toll for, you know, over a 9-month period to play at that level, 20 games potentially. That's a lot to put on someone. At the same time, is it any less risky to ask them to play in the midst of a pandemic and, you know, risk the exposure of coronavirus, all the uncertainty that Kevin Warren mentioned? So I think it's a very difficult question to answer.
I'm going to get this number wrong, so bear with me, but I remember in the mid to late 90s in the NFL, there were like a series of knee injuries to running backs, and it was like this magic number of like, I think it was like 420-plus touches, whether it be catching the ball, whether it be running the ball. And if you did that over the course of a season, there were like 7 or 8 running backs that blew out their knee the next year. It was ridiculous, and it kept going on. And, it was absolutely crazy to see injury after injury happening to these so-called workhorse running backs. And it was like the league had to sit up and take notice. Like, there is a tipping point on how many touches you can get before you suffer a serious injury. And they kind of started doing more, you know, dual back formation. They started doing different things to combat that because of the certainty of injury or the number of injuries that were occurring with guys that were used in that fashion. So I would hate to have to do that kind of research in a college season
right.
or two, right? You know what I mean? You just don't want to see that being a necessary thing to look into.
You know, I think we're going to hear a lot of proposals and ideas, and Pat Forty, our pal, who just tweeted out, he received an interesting one from Purdue head coach Jeff Brohm about how it might work, what we're just talking about, how you would have an 8-game season starting the end of February in the Big Ten with a playoff in May, and then your fall season would start in October of 2021, and it's 10 games. And that way it's a little bit more palatable, maybe a little bit more easy to approach, and maybe from a health and safety standpoint, a little bit safer to consider. I don't know if that would be enough, but I do think that's better than the alternative. I just feel like right now I would implore people I would recommend them try to come up with these sort of creative solutions to a spring fall combination than to send players out there right now when you just don't know how bad it could get and how easy it is to contain. That, to me, that uncertainty, I would think, scares me more than trying to structure 2 seasons in 9 months like this proposal from Purdue would do.
312-644-6767. We're going to shift gears a little bit. We're going to get into some NFL. We're going to talk to Brad Biggs. It's Biggs time next. It's Mully and Haw on Chicago Sports Radio 6-7 of the Score.
Brad Biggs. Biggs time.
Biggs.
With Mully and Haw. Biggs time.
The Biggs Report.
With Brad Biggs.
Biggs time.
Biggs.
His name is Brad Biggs.
Brad Biggs talks football with you.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 6-7 at the Score. Brad Biggs, the football man of the Chicago Tribune, a longtime contributor to the station and a valued friend, that he joins us on the Al Pamonte Ford Hotline, Al Pamonte Ford in Melrose Park. Big Zay!
Morning, Brad.
Morning, boys. What's going on?
Bears, 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 Bears. How about this? They are winning so far on offense. Those quarterbacks look phenomenal.
Well, the quarterbacks for the first time yesterday were able to throw routes to their wide receivers on air, which means with no defensive players on the other side of the line of scrimmage to perhaps get in the way. So that gives everyone a pretty clear picture of where they're at in terms of what they're allowed to do on the field to this point. And things will ramp up beginning Monday when they can have their first padded practice. The other 31 teams, with the exception of the two that are going to kick it off with a Thursday night game, are in the same boat on the same timeline, and they are anxious to sort of get this thing moving forward because, as Matt Nagy explained yesterday, a real evaluation of the quarterbacks, Mitch Trubisky and Nick Foles, and really everyone else, can't get going until Monday when they put the pads on and we start to see something that resembles real football. Pretty easy for any of their quarterbacks to look fantastic when there's, you know, no pass rush, no defensive backs, no linebackers to avoid any of that. But it helps them work on timing, and you hope, guys, that this acclimation period that they've gone through will prevent some injuries once they do get to the real football, because they went an entire offseason without doing any of that work at Halas Hall, where you're ensuring that their bodies are ready for the grind.
And 1 month from today, Brad, the Bears are scheduled to open against the Detroit Lions. And I think that until then, it's going to be really difficult to have these real true evaluation periods where it gives you a sense of what you really have or what you don't have. So I wonder how much of this is going to be coaches seeing what they want to see, or maybe ignoring what they choose to ignore. And I wonder if competition really is the right word. I wonder if they have somebody in mind, a quarterback, and they're just going to wait and see if everybody stays healthy, how they look, and the fact that they, you know, if they don't do anything terrible, this is the way they want to go.
I wouldn't rule that out. They maintain that this thing's, you know, wide open, and we'll see what shakes out. But I've often wondered myself something similar, that when, you know, a team says they've got a competition, is that just they put the guys out there and, you know, 9 times out of 10, they end up with the decision that they were sort of predisposed for in the first place. The challenge here, the real challenge, and as you mentioned, 1 month away from having to play the Lions at Ford Field, is they're going to be 8 or 9 practices in full pads. And I asked Matt yesterday what a best case scenario is in terms of a timeline for making a decision. You know, what in a perfect world, when can you come up with this decision? And I guess predictably, you know, he really didn't answer the question at all, but I know that in normal times, let's pretend there's 4 preseason games. In normal times, teams want to have their starters ironed out and determined at least 2 weeks before the start of the regular season. So, and that's at least. And so if you apply that to where the Bears are at right now, they're what, you know, 16 days away from making a decision. You know, it's 2.5 weeks away from having to pull the trigger on, you know, player X is going to be the starting quarterback against the Lions.
You know, what's fascinating to me, I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday about the way certain kind of precision surgical injuries can damage a team. And we were kind of going through the Bears roster a little bit, and we were talking about this idea of, you know, who would they miss the most. And I'm not sure it's not Kyle Fuller, because I don't know that
I was
going to
blurt
that
name out. Yeah.
Okay. And it was interesting because we had this conversation because, you know, obviously, you know, when you talk about Khalil Mack being their best player, you talk about Eddie Jackson, those kind of injuries would be so damaging to a team. But when you're talking about just one bad break that could fell you, it might be the corner, given their lack of depth at the position.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. They've got some options there, and they're certainly very interested in seeing the second round pick Jalen Johnson get out there. And if you go by what people said about his performance at Utah, the Bears have got a chance to maybe have a pretty good player opposite Fuller, but you don't know, and he's super young. And the rest of the guys in the group, and I like Buster Skrine as a nickel. I think he's above average, pretty good. You know, he's fine in that spot for them. Buster Skrine on the outside, it could be a liability, I think, at times, and that's been proven out in previous stops in his career. The other guys, you got some guys that might be able to get you through a game, but unless Artie Burns is a completely different player than he was for the Pittsburgh Steelers, unless Kevin Tolliver is ready to make a big step forward, yeah, you've got some huge question marks after Fuller, and that makes him really, as you said, one of the most indispensable guys on the roster.
Brad, not to get into how the sausage is made necessarily, but when you're talking about a quarterback competition, a lot of times the eyes from the outside, when you're watching practice, you can tell certain things from the media standpoint. Fans have open practices. How much will the media be allowed to watch practices and what's actually going on, or will this be something that is relatively closed and you're going to have to take the word of the coaching staff and Matt Nagy and everybody else of what's actually happened?
Well, that's a great question, and one that maybe we'll learn a little bit more about starting Monday, when there are going to be some media allowed to watch the practice in full pads. You know, assuming the practices and pads are open and the entire session is open, media ought to have a decent view or vantage point of what's going on in those most important workouts that they've had. If they're not really putting too many tallies on the scorecard this week and the week before when they're working on air at most, yeah, you would think the media would be able to see a good deal of it. But we'll have to see. You know, that's a couple days off. Not until Monday. I'm not sure if they're going to make the media stand behind trees so they can't sneeze on anybody. I'm not sure yet.
You know, I listen, I respect all the protocols and everything they're trying to do to get their season in. And I know we're joking about any outsiders that come into their little bubble of players and all that stuff. But I think what we've seen with baseball, Brad, is that there are some players that have kind of let down their teams, right? That's not being overselling the story, but, you know, you saw what happened with Cleveland. Now it ended up not being a huge event yet, but Mike Clevinger, what he did going out and not coming forward and then flying home with the team and all that stuff, how do you police that with such a larger group of players? And you can talk to them all you want about it, but it comes down to personal choices. And I'm sure they're going out of their way to try to get everyone on board with what they're doing. But how do they actually police that? How do they actually know what people are up to?
You know, it's interesting. I was on the horn with the GM the other day, and I brought up that same thing with him. I said, not the Clevinger thing, but the baseball,
right? It,
comparison with football rosters, when you look at the practice squad this year with 16 guys, you're talking about having 69 players on the roster. The baseball coaching staffs are minuscule compared to football, where some teams have 20 or more coaches when you count them all up. So the sheer numbers, football, much larger. And the question I had for him is, I said, geez, I said, you know, you're putting trust in a roster of 69 players, a lot of them really young, that every day when they leave your facility, they're going to make smart decisions that are keeping the team first, and they're going to be as safe as possible to not bring anything into the building, into the locker room. And you know, he sort of admitted, yeah, that you're just constantly preaching, doing the right thing to them. You know, you're coming at them from all angles, from, you know, the owner, the top of the organization, to the coaching staff, continuing to kind of drill it home, and then relying on veterans in the locker room. And then the point he made was, like, he thought that travel for football was going to be much, much easier than baseball, because he said, you know, when they go on the road, it's a little more than 24 hours. He said, what are we not going to have? Well, you know, the player isn't going to go out to dinner with his agent, which happens a lot on the road. The player's not going to be able to see his family or college buddies that he might be able to do for an hour and a half or 2 hours when they go on the road. That he said the vast majority of the time when they go on the road is in meetings, sleeping, or at the stadium. That there really isn't a lot of time. So he felt that they could certainly avoid the sort of Indians thing with Zach Plesac and Mike Clevenger out on the town in Chicago in football. But I just wonder about 69 guys on a roster, you making the right decision at all times, because he admitted, he's like, hey, he said, I don't know if we can get through 16 games. And he said the fear every day is that you're going to have some spread of COVID-19 through your building.
Football question before we let you go, Brad. Did the Cowboys signing Everson Griffin give them the best pass rush in the NFC now?
Boy, they got a pretty good one. They got a pretty good one. And because Griffin with DeMarcus Lawrence and the collection of other guys there. Yeah, that Minnesota was on the trail trying to get Griffin back into the mix. He's been a pretty productive player for them. You wonder if the Cowboys, freeing up a little bit of cap space with some opt-outs there, were able to nail that down. I believe what I saw was it was a $6 million 1 year deal for him. They're going to be impressive up front on defense. There's no question about that.
All righty, Brad. Thank you, buddy. Great stuff as always.
Good stuff.
Have a great
Brad,
day,
thanks.
Guys.
You too.
That is our guy, Brad Biggs, football man at the Tribune. And we're going to bring in Gordon Whitmire next. We'll talk about the Cubs. I want to talk about how good they are. Do we have a good feel for how good they are? We know how what the record says. We know what they've done. We're not going to see them against the Dodgers till the playoffs, and then the Yankees in the World Series, right? So we'll ask Gordon if
your sarcasm is great. It's
how
awesome.
Is that sarcasm?
Oh, come on.
That's how it plays out. It's Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 6-7 to the Score.
Cubs win. Gordon Whitmire taking you inside the Cubs clubhouse. Cubs win. Chicago Cubs. Yeah. Gordon Whitmire.
Mully and Haw, Chicago Sports Radio 6-7 to the Score. Gordon Whitmire joins us on the Alphamonte Ford Hotline, Alphamonte Ford in Melrose Park. Morning, Gordon. How are you?
Morning, Gordon.
Morning. Doing great. How are you guys?
Oh, we're living the dream, and boy, it's been fun to watch the Cubs. They just like a tremendous machine, Secretariat. They are really just kind of plowing ahead here. And you know, we were talking about how you evaluate them. How good are they? I mean, it seems like, you know, when you look at their opponents, they're obviously a lot better than them. When you look at the teams that they are catching at the times they're catching them, you could argue that they've been doing a great job of that, which isn't something you can plan for. But how good are they? I mean, do we have any idea? Can they rout the Dodgers, the Yankees? Who's the best team in baseball? Are the Cubs in that conversation?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's the question, because you're right. They really haven't played anybody. The best team on their schedule so far was Cleveland, and Cleveland's in a mess right now. You know, their clubhouse is even getting pulled apart at the seams with what happened with Plesac and Clevenger. And they missed Clevenger, I mean, just in a baseball sense. He was supposed to start against them Tuesday, And instead, they got Adam Pletko. They wind up scoring 15 runs in a two-game sweep against a team that hadn't allowed more than four in a game, I think, all season. So you don't know. You don't know. But, you know, this is such a weird season. What we do have a pretty good idea so far of is that they're as good as most, if not all, of the teams. Most of the teams in that 10-team Central stack that includes the Centrals from both leagues. I mean, just take a look at this. So they're off to a 12-3 start. That's historic for them. It's, you know, they've 1907, they started 13-02. They've started 12-3 one other year since then, and it was not 2016. It was 1970. Now, that didn't turn out so good. But that team had to play the Dodgers. This one doesn't. So they've got 45 games left, 31 of them against NL Central opponents. Every one of their Central opponents in the NL has a losing record. So 31 of their next 45 against teams with losing records. Six of them against the White Sox, who until the last 2 days had a losing record. Three of them against the Tigers, who they're a losing team. Let's face it. I mean, they got a winning record right now, but that team's crap. And they only have two more against Cleveland. The one good team, the one slam dunk good team that you can count on is going to be there at the end in this, and it has a chance at a playoff run, a deep playoff run, are the Twins. They only played them three times, and not until the last 2 weeks of the season. It's possible they could have a playoff berth clinch by then. And they get them at home. They don't even have to play them on the road. So everything lines up for them as we sit here right now. And they're one of the healthiest teams in baseball. The coronavirus, for sure. They've had no positive tests. But beyond that, I mean, you got pitchers dropping left and right throughout baseball. And the Cubs have stayed remarkably healthy in that way, too. So they're in really good position, even if we don't know yet if they're as good as their record, put it that way.
Health is the biggest deal, Gordon. You're right. So bring us up to date on where Quintana is and his return, Chris Bryant with his wrist, Schwarber with his knee, and is Anthony Rizzo's neck okay after carrying those extra gold chains around for the last couple of nights?
Yeah, Rizzo's in the most dangerous, precarious position if he keeps wearing those damn chains. Bryant said he felt okay after the game last night. They turned his wrist a little bit on a diving catch. He stayed in the game. He hit a home run a half an inning later. Took him out with a half inning to go. Ross said it just made sense where the lineup was to sub out and put the stronger defense across the outfield at that point. Plus, he wanted to get him out of there with the wrist. We'll see. The day-to-day thing, we've seen things sideline him in the past that we weren't sure we're going to. So this bears watching today and tomorrow to see how it responds overnight and into these next couple of days. But Quintana supposedly is looking really good. He had another simulated game through three innings worth. And Ross said that he's good enough that he's not even talking about that hand, that thumb that he cut and injured, that nerve damage that he had in there. That's not even an issue that he's bringing up as he discusses where he's at throwing the baseball. He's throwing all his pitches. It's just a matter of getting him stretched out. And the way the rotation's pitching right now, we'll see what Chatwood looks like next time out after the way he looked last time, and we'll see how a guy like Mills responds to the long layoff. We already saw Hendricks and Lester looked real good after that unexpected layoff. To see if they even feel they need to rush anything. But Quintana's in a position now where the next time he pitches, you could start to set a timeline for him, and it shouldn't be too far down the road. And then Schwarber's knee, he got whacked pretty hard with a pitch right in a bad spot, and he was scratched from the lineup yesterday, but came off the bench late to pinch hit and seems okay. So, I mean, that's amazing when you consider there's something like 60 pitchers around baseball that have already gone on the DL with injuries, which is more than half, more than twice as many as either of the last 2 years at this point. So the Cubs have escaped a lot of what has been derailing teams coast to coast already.
You know, we were talking a little bit earlier about Kyle Hendricks, just kind of appreciating his performance yesterday. He hadn't pitched since August 4th, and you get some extra time, and all you see are the, you know, he's snapping off curveballs. His changeup was fantastic, and he just operates so professionally. He doesn't walk anyone. He doesn't get in. He doesn't get his own way. You know, he just kind of. It's just such a joy to watch the way that guy pitches, because we don't see that enough around baseball.
Yeah, and you know, there's been, for probably the last 15 years at least, there's been this trend toward extreme velocity.
Right.
And now that we've got pitch labs everywhere, it's extreme velocity measured with the Rapsodo machines and your spin rates, and people are getting contracts now without necessarily the performance behind them, because some of the numbers on the machines tell teams they can fix them and do something with them. And the Cubs have had a couple of those cases. The Astros have done it with a few guys. So teams have had enough success at that's this thing. But here's a guy that just knows how to pitch. Here's a guy that if you dropped him into the game unknown now as a young guy doing essentially what he does or would have the kind of upside that we're seeing now, he might not get the looks that he had a chance to get and the ability to prove himself. But what he's proving is that locating, mixing speeds, and changing directions can win baseball games at any level, even if you throw 10 mile an hour slower with your hardest pitch than a lot of these guys in vogue right now. And this guy, he's been really statistically, honestly, this guy's been their best pitcher since he broke in 2014. Not always for a particular half season or a season, but from that time to now, he's been their most consistent and best pitcher. And he's exactly what the doctor ordered for this staff this year.
Not a lot to complain about when you look at the Cubs lineup, Gordon, but Nico Horner's had a tough month. He struggled, I think, one for his last 16 and one hit this month in August. Jason Kipnis played in Cleveland for obvious reasons. It was a good matchup also back in town where he played for so long. What's the future at second base hold, and what's wrong with Nico Horner?
Nico Horner's just young. He's not Luis Robert, although we often like to say that. But that's supposed to be a joke. Look, he's a good hitter. He's a contact guy. He's still getting his legs under him in the big leagues. Hasn't seen a lot of pitching, and so these things will happen for stretches. I think you'll see him in there again, especially when you get the Alex Mills types back on a mound. You might have seen him in there yesterday, if not for it being in Cleveland, where you know Jason Kipnis, again, you said the obvious choice. I mean, this guy played with just a little more life going back home to Cleveland for a couple of days. I think he reached base twice in each one of those games. But the Hendricks, the Mills, the guys who they're going to put the ball in play against, a lot of times you're going to see Horner in there because he's their best defensive option at second base. And so I expect to see more of him. And if he gets hot again, you'll see David Ross play the hot hand. That's what he promised to do. That's kind of what's going on right now with that. It's just amazing how many guys in that lineup seem to have the hot hand. And it seems like whoever they put in the 7, 8, 9 holes seem to produce as a trio pretty much game to game. What it tells you is that some of the guys, a couple of the players were saying it, I think Jed Hoyer said it, that they thought their team was built particularly well for the DH because they thought they had the kind of hitters that weren't getting a lot of playing time, that had bats sitting on the bench, that they could really do a lot with the lineup by adding that hitter and then being able to shuffle around to the mixing and matching up and down the lineup. And they're right. I mean, so far they're right. But again, What did we say earlier? They haven't played anybody, right?
That's right.
Gordon, thanks a ton. We appreciate it, buddy.
Good stuff,
Gordon.
All right,
guys, take it easy.
Yep. Good talking to you. That's Gordon Whitmire. All right, we're gonna take a moment. We'll come back with Jamal Myers. We got a big game today, buddy. This is it for your Chicago Blackhawks. It's not it. It's not an elimination game.
Big one. It's
they
big.
They need to make a statement, right? Dustin, yeah. Is that it? Or is it a must-win? I always get confused. We'll talk to Jammer about it next. Mully and Hall on the Score.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.